Reverend Dr. Jeffrey Kloa has been teaching at Concordia Seminary St. Louis since 1999, most of that time as a professor of exegetical theology, but since 2013 as provost or chief academic officer. He is, of course, a New Testament professor, having completed a PhD at the University of Leeds in the United Kingdom, compiling a textual commentary on 1 Corinthians for the dissertation to complete the degree. In his 14-plus years at the St. Louis Seminary, Dr. Kloa has taught a wide range of exegetical courses and been in great demand at pastoral conferences, continuing ed sites, been on radio and television, and presented in such academic venues as the Society of Biblical Literature. His articles and book reviews are too numerous to mention here, but in glancing them over, I detected several common themes. Several papers on text criticism, practical issues the early Christians faced at Corinth and elsewhere, and one paper I particularly liked and reacted to several years ago, entitled The Transcongregational Church in the New Testament, Concordia Journal 2008, a really fine piece, in my opinion. He has been involved in larger projects too, most notably the Lutheran Study Bible, and a tribute to his advisor, Professor J. Keith Elliott, entitled Texts and Traditions, co-edited by both himself and Peter Doble, and published by Brill just last year in 2014. Text criticism has certainly advanced since I was a seminary student back in the day. Now, computerized searches speed up the process considerably, and new techniques make for some text-critical decisions that often leave me and other pastors of my generation baffled. I think there is need of perhaps a series of short articles documenting how text criticism has come to be in the state that it is today, and helping our church to use the advanced tools critically without jettisoning the Word of God as just a, shall I say it, plastic text. There is a balance here that has yet to be reached, and I'm hopeful, confident even, that Dr. Kloa will help our church to achieve it in good time. Now he is going to direct our attention to consideration of a text wherein text criticism figures mightily. Dr. Kloa's paper is entitled Manuscripts and Texts of the New Testament, a case study on the textual tradition of 1 Corinthians 14, 34 to 35. Join me in welcoming Dr. Kloa to the podium.
Good morning. And the peace of Christ be with you. Thank you. Thanks, John, for that very overly kind introduction. And I'd definitely like to thank Dr. Just and the Exegetical Department for the opportunity to speak at the symposium here. I find great joy in the shared work that we have at Concordia Seminary and Concordia Theological Seminary in forming pastors and missionaries and deaconesses and leaders for the sake of the gospel. So I thank you for the shared work that we have there, and also for the opportunity to talk with you today. I never thought I'd say this before a presentation, but I hope that you are completely bored out of your mind today. And John, by the way, I haven't used that word that begins with a P for about 14 months now. So anyway, just to set this up a little bit, I thought long and hard, sort of, about what to talk about here today and how to approach this. You might have heard that I gave a paper yesterday also for the Lutheran Concerns Association that was kind of more about the issue specifically of the problem of the text and a Lutheran view of the authority of the text. I frankly thought about just reading that paper again because I think it was okay, but it's you've probably already read it on the internet anyway. And it will be posted on the internet, so go ahead. And also, you know, I have some things on iTunes from that paper in Oberursel. So I thought I'd take a little different track today and walk through, just from a fundamental level, what are we dealing with when we're looking at the text of the New Testament? What are the actual manuscripts, the artifacts from the history of the church that have brought that text down to us in our day? And how does the way that we now come at the text, or better, the text approaches us, in things like critical printed editions, how does that shape the way that we hear the text? How does that shape how we read the text? And so I want to highlight how the church brought this text down to us, and I think there's some helpful things that we can glean from that. Sorry, I'm a few slides ahead here. So my first part of the paper is going to be a sort of introduction, you might say, to the manuscripts. And the second part will be rather more technical, where we'll actually get down into details. And I hope you brought your Greek text along. It is an exegetical symposium. So I don't care which edition you have, just have a Greek text, okay? So my doctor father, as John mentioned, J. Keith Elliott, is fond of telling a story about textual critics. When he was a young scholar, he was at an academic conference, and a major gospel scholar came up to him and asked him what he was studying and what his area of work was. He told him textual criticism, and the response that he got was, well, textual critics are kind of like plumbers. You only call on them when the plumbing is stuck and you want to get rid of a mess. Just get it out of the way. And once the mess is cleared up, just go away and don't bother us anymore. Right? And I'm not pleased entirely with the implication that textual critics are, at least most of the time, completely useless, right? But I at least appreciate the fact that the scholar recognized that neither plumbers nor textual critics are the ones who created the mess. They're only there to try to fix it. And I think that's actually a helpful image, because a lot of times, in practice, we don't need to think about the plumbing, right? You turn the water on, and water comes out. You drink it, you bathe in it, everything is fine. And that's actually, I think, a healthy view of our manuscripts. Most of the time, we don't need to think about the manuscripts or the plumbing. But when the water stops flowing, or somebody plugs up something, then we need to take a look. Okay, so I kind of keep that image in your mind as we work through this today. We're going to look at some pipes, okay? Some stuff that you might not normally look at, and at a particular problem that's of significant controversy today for a number of reasons in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. So again, we seem to have entered a period in our life as a church in the Western world when textual criticism is something to be feared, as if it is something that risks challenging the authority of the Bible. And Chuck mentioned this earlier, the Newsweek magazine piece published a few weeks ago, full of non sequiturs and false information, frankly. But in the ancient church, the greatest students of the biblical text were, in their own way, textual critics. Jerome, Augustine, Origen, Irenaeus all knew about manuscripts. They knew about variant readings. And they tried to unstuck the plumbing when they found that they needed to, so that the meaning of the text would be clear and that they would know it thoroughly. So again, my goal today is to introduce you to manuscripts, the actual physical artifacts that carried the wording of the New Testament writings in Greek, Latin, Coptic, until the first printed edition appeared in 1516, which I believe marked a significant shift in how we view the text. I am convinced that study of the manuscripts, rather than relying solely on printed editions, is attainable, even for pastors, and indeed helpful, and can equip us to understand more fully and confidently the very words of the text. I will also demonstrate how study of the manuscripts can help us become more confident about the biblical text by looking at a familiar passage that has been questioned in recent years, 1 Corinthians 14. So here's a manuscript page. It might look familiar to you. It's Codex Sinaiticus from the 4th century. It's available now online in a beautiful digital edition. If you get bored today and want something to do, go to codexsinaiticus.org and go ahead and play with it. But I just want to take a look at this, because this is very different from even 10 years ago when I started my graduate work. In my day, I used to have to write a letter to a library in Paris or Italy and ask for a microfilm and hope that they would deign to send it to me. The French were particularly unhelpful. I had to write letters in French. Otherwise, I wouldn't respond, and it would take 9 months to get these things. Now, these things are just online, high-res digital image for free. And so you, as pastors, as teachers, can access these things and see exactly what these things are doing. And I just want to point out a couple of things about this. This is the end of Galatians, Galatians 5, the end of the letter at the bottom of the third column, I should hear. And then Ephesians begins at the top of the fourth column. Notice a couple of things immediately. There's no chapter divisions. There's no verse references. There's some paragraphing, okay, to help us get an idea of some of the sense. But there's other features that might strike us as a little unusual. For example, you notice these lists, the works of the flesh in Galatians 5, and then the fruit of the Spirit in column format, right? Notice, as you look at this, your eye is drawn immediately to that part of the page, right? It's a reading experience that's different from what we have in our printed editions. And this also, I might point out, caused problems because, you know, these things are easy to spot on the page. And as you know, the Apostle Paul frequently had lists like this in his letters. And so copyists would, oh, I saw another one of those over in Colossians. And so some of the words would come together. So you see assimilations that occur in places like this that you would not in other places. Okay. So again, by looking at the actual physical artifacts, the documents that carried the text, it gives us insight into what the church was doing with the texts, what kind of things they were emphasizing, how they were trying to make it clear. I don't have with me a list of websites to go to. I can talk about some of that later on if you like. But it's remarkable, the number of resources that are available online. And I hope that you have opportunity to make use of these, even perhaps in sermon preparation. Go ahead and take a look at a manuscript. And my reason for encouraging this again is because I believe that working with the manuscripts will help us deal with the specifics of the text. It forces us to deal with the difficulties that copyists faced. It helps us draw our attention to difficulties of syntax, right? Why did they change this? Why are they slowing down here and trying to make this work? It draws our attention to difficulties of vocabulary. Why did they shift this word? Why was there discomfort with this word, perhaps? Or a lack of clarity? Indeed, even what are some of the theological issues that copyists or editors or readers sometimes had to deal with in the transmission of the text? In other words, by looking at manuscripts and what copyists were actually doing, it forces us to take each word of the text seriously, as if we were retracing, letter by letter, the words given by the Spirit through the apostles and handed down to us, quite literally, one letter at a time, one manuscript at a time, for us now to pass on to the congregations that have been entrusted to us for the faithful teaching of the Word. And again, it will help us as pastors deal with challenging questions that our people do, in fact, hear about in the popular media, and we don't need to talk a whole lot about that. So what was the early church perspective on the manuscripts? When the church fathers came to write sermons, do doctrinal treatises, they had in front of them a hand-produced copy of the text, or perhaps a couple, as we see in some church fathers. That's very different from what we do when we come at a text. We have a printed, industrially produced kind of tidied up, cleaned up text. That's not what the early church fathers had, and you can see the way this is reflected in their writings. So I may be stating the obvious here, but just some basics. For the first 1,500 years of the church's life, there was no single text. There were only thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, of manuscripts, individual copies produced by hand of the Gospels, of the Pauline epistles, of the Catholic epistles, sometimes Revelation, right, Chuck? There's some 6,000 of these, yes, six, you're being optimistic there. Anyway, some 6,000 of these still exist in Greek alone, about 600 from prior to the 10th century. Some of these are very large and extensive, like the Codex Sinaiticus from the 4th century. Others are only really little scraps, and we'll take a look at a couple of these. But all of them, and this needs to be kept in mind, produced by the church for the church. They were using these with the confession that the Holy Spirit spoke by the prophets. The challenge for us is that no two of those manuscripts are identical. They differ from one another. And none of them, quite obviously, is the original manuscript for any writing of the New Testament. Now, is this a problem or not? In one sense, none of this matters at all. You can turn on the faucet and the water comes out, right? We can read our Bibles in clear, readable translations, preach sermons from them, and not worry one bit about manuscripts and the differences. And I hope that actually we all fall into this category, at least most of the time, the vast majority of time, that we are encountered by the Scriptures. But at other times, and I want to talk to you pastors here specifically for a minute, at other times, especially for those who have had the privilege of being instructed in Greek, there is a desire to understand and define as precisely as possible the meaning of the text, including the differences in meaning that are presented by the different manuscripts. Our respect for the Scriptures as authoritative and normative require, I believe, the most careful study that we are able to devote to it, because the church has invested huge resources in you and I learning these languages so that we can teach these faithfully to our people. Now, there's something of a fine line that we must walk here. It is common in discussions of the issue of the stability of the text to make assertions like 97% of the text is certain. I talked about this a bit yesterday. Now, that's true based on comparisons of all printed editions for the last 500 years. You lay them all alongside each other from 1516 to 2013, and about 97% of the time the wording agrees. That's great. But at the same time, I believe that we shouldn't just be satisfied with 97%, as if it's good enough and not worth our effort and attention to become as certain as we possibly can be about that other 3% of the text. And you're certainly aware of this. There are plenty of people today who will claim that even that 97% is a false description. I think that's wrong, but we'll talk about that. So again, at the outset, we have to understand that a manuscript is a hand-produced object. An image I like to use is that a manuscript is like looking at a hand-sewn quilt. You look at two quilts, handmade, produced by the same person with the same pattern, and from a distance, they're going to look virtually identical. You wouldn't be able to tell the difference even from 10 feet away. But if you got right up to them and counted the number of stitches and the size of each block, you're going to find little differences among those handmade manuscripts. No two quilts will ever be completely identical. That's why they're handmade. And in fact, these differences and unique features are what make them so valuable, especially if the quilter is your mother or grandmother or a dear friend. Now, both authors and scribes in the ancient world understood full well that the text that they were producing and copying would sooner or later be changed. Because there was no copyright law, once a text was in hand, anyone could produce a copy on their own. They could sell it, the author would have no control over its further copying or sale. Furthermore, the author would have no control over the wording of the text. Once he lets it go into the world, it's subject to anything that could happen to a manuscript. Changes could be made in subsequent copies, which neither the author could control nor actually the buyer have any knowledge about as he commissions more often or sometimes purchases a copy. Now, there were several ways that authors would try to minimize this problem. Some would insert warnings of various kinds to copyists, you know, Book of Revelation, you see this. Others would write in their text, even into poems, this is really interesting, the names and locations of the bookseller with whom the author had entrusted his master copy. So in the text itself, he would say, go to this guy's place on this street if you want to get the original. It's a way to kind of guarantee. Even in poems, it's kind of funny. But changes in subsequent copies were inevitable. And this is a manuscript of Aristotle from the first, second century. And the textual tradition of Aristotle is pretty interesting. And I'm just going to read a quote here. It seems that Aristotle edited his own writings. He produced his own authoritative edition and authorized master copies for publication or copying. Now, 250 years after Aristotle's death, books, copies surfaced in Rome that showed additions by Aristotle's hand in the margins. And these apparently were Aristotle's personal copies, which he likely used during his lectures, noting ideas in abbreviated format that was difficult for anyone but the author to kind of decipher. You know how you have notes in your Greek New Testament, and you know what they mean, and nobody else does. Hopefully you don't use those for quizzes, right? You don't put your verb tenses. But anyway, now the Roman publishers who discovered these manuscripts, actually Aristotle's personal copies, but different from his authoritative formal edition. 250 years later in Rome, these surfaced, and these booksellers edited these and tried to incorporate the notes into Aristotle's text, and you can imagine what happened. In the end, they produced a text so full of repetitions and discrepancies that it became very difficult to actually understand what Aristotle was saying. But these editions sold so well that they completely replaced the older versions, which had been edited by Aristotle himself. So the textual tradition for Aristotle has been completely corrupted by well-meaning scribes who had access to different textual streams. We also need to keep in mind that scribes were very aware of their shortcomings. I talked about this yesterday. A frequent prayer read by copyists at the end of Greek manuscripts of the New Testament from the late medieval period, it's very common actually, reads as follows. O reader, in spiritual love, forgive me, and pardon the daring of him who wrote, and turn his errors into some mystic good. So these scribes, whose work shows them to be fully trained and highly competent, 10th century and later, they definitely know what they're doing, nevertheless knew that they had made mistakes as they made copies, that it was an act of daring to make a copy. But at the same time, they didn't want to concede that these errors would disrupt the message, that nevertheless, God would turn those errors into some mystic good, because after all, it's his text, right? So that's what's been striking to me about working with the manuscripts, is that these are copied by individual people who view their vocation, if you will, as passing that word down faithfully, yet with the skills and abilities that they have. Working directly with the manuscripts reminds us that the text was received and passed down in much the same way that it is with us. We each have our own strengths and weaknesses in our teaching and in our preaching. We each have our own phrases and ways of saying things. And the same is true of the copyists who produce the manuscripts. And if you have a chance to read a book or two all the way through in a manuscript, after a while you sort of get to know what the copyist is doing. You anticipate the kind of things he's going to do, the way he spells things, the kind of mistakes he's going to make. He's a guy trying to do his vocation faithfully. And it's just fun sometimes, excuse me, to see these things in a manuscript. This is a copy of Codex Sanguilensis. It's a Vulgate manuscript of the Pauline epistles, produced in about the 6th century. And it's the end of 1 Corinthians 5 and the beginning of 1 Corinthians 6. And so it's in your Latin kind of insular script. And it's not too bad to work through. So working with this manuscript and flipped the page one day and found this in the margin in 6:1. You know? It's like, and you know, so I was like, what the heck is this? Look, nowhere else in the entire manuscript is anything like this found. But one day the guy just got bored and you know, Kilroy was here. You know, I mean, I don't know. I hope it's not a self-portrait. I don't know. But that's the point again. These are actual people producing these texts and passing them down to us. One of my favorite lines at the end of a book manuscript is, the end of the book, thanks be to God. Finally done. Anyway, so you try to make a 142 folio or 142 leaf copy of a manuscript and see how much you enjoy it. Anyway, the early theologians of the church were likewise fully aware of the realities of working with manuscripts, for they had in front of them handmade copies of the New Testament writings, and they themselves as authors were aware of what it meant to have copies of their own works produced by scribes, and the inevitable alterations and confusions that would occur in the copies of their own writings. Many early theologians comment upon the differences that they find in the biblical manuscripts. For example, Jerome, who is one of the greatest language scholars, I think the greatest language scholar, well, Origen, of the early church, who translated the Old Testament from Hebrew and at least the Gospels from Greek into Latin. And he received a question, actually from a layperson, sort of an email, I guess you'd say, about the differences in chronology between the gospel accounts regarding the time of day of Jesus' resurrection. And Jerome is interesting in his response. He offers two possible explanations. He says, quote, "This problem has a twofold solution. Either we do not accept the testimony of Mark because this final portion is not contained in most of the Gospels that bear his name, almost all the Greek codices lacking it, or else we must affirm that Matthew and Mark have both told the truth, that our Lord rose on the evening of the Sabbath and that he was seen by Mary Magdalene in the morning of the first day of the week." This is Epistle 120 to Hibidia, or Hibidia there. Now, Jerome is commenting on the Latin version because that's who his correspondent, the language that his correspondent is reading. And thus he notes that the longer ending of Mark is in the some Latin manuscripts, but is missing, as he says, in almost all the Greek codices or manuscripts. And the longer ending of Mark, what we call the longer ending, is that which causes the perceived chronological discrepancy with Matthew. Now, among the Greek manuscripts of Mark that survive, only three lack the ending, two of which happen to be the oldest available for that portion of Mark. Now, this reminds us, in other words, Jerome's evidence for the manuscript attestation and our evidence, what has survived to our days, is different in this issue. Nevertheless, here we're going. Jerome significantly does not feel compelled to make a final determination about which is the original reading. He notes the differences in the manuscripts and then offers interpretations based on both possibilities. He assumes that even the longer reading, the one missing from the Greek manuscripts, must have, quote, told the truth. Significantly, he does not seem to feel compelled to determine the original reading and discard the other. He can view both readings as true. And this ambivalence, if you will, maybe that's not the right word, but this better word is maybe humility. Let's let it stand and try to work with what we got, is seen even in the manuscripts. And note this image, what I'm describing now, is not available in your textual apparatus. You only find this by actually looking at an image of the manuscript. So this is, and you might have seen this is Codex Vaticanus at the end of Mark. And You probably can't see it from that far away, but it ends with Ephabunto Gar, and then a little, you know, kind of etching or draw a line to indicate the end of the book. And Katamarkon, so the end of the gospel. And in every other place in Codex Vaticanus, which has the Old Testament, the Apocrypha, and at least most of the New Testament, where it's not damaged, in every other place at the end of the book, the next book begins immediately on the next column. Now, it bleeds through, the ink on the backside bleeds through here, but this is blank in the manuscript. And significantly, Luke does not begin in the next column. It begins on the next side. And the best interpretation of this is that the copyist who produced this manuscript was aware of other endings. We don't know which. You know, there's actually kind of four different endings to Mark. We're not sure what he would have known, but he knows that there's a problem and leaves it for others to decide if a better idea or a better solution comes along to fill it in later. It's a way of dealing with the problem of the text and not feeling compelled to just nail it and be done with it and go on. It's an openness to hearing the word continuously. Just briefly, I'll show you. This is in a 11th century manuscript of Mark. It's actually several manuscripts in this family that have a similar notation. And it's a minuscule text, so they said nothing. Ephabunto Gar, there's your minuscule text, ends. And notice the script. And then you got these lines that indicate a break. And then in a different script, right, in some of the copies, up to here is completed the evangelist, up to which also Eusebius Pamphilius ec canonicin. And there's a debate as to whether that means considered canonical or added the canon numbers, you know, the Eusebian canons. But then he adds, but in many copies also, these things are brought forth. And then you see the what we call verse 9, Anastas de Proe, in the same script as verse 8. So they know about the problem, but they allow the reader to sort through this. In other words, there's a gathering. There's a making sure that they're not losing anything of the truth. Now, this may seem odd to us. We more often operate with notions of one reading being right, which necessarily makes the other reading wrong. Now, at times, the early fathers did the same, to be sure. They were fully capable of rendering judgment on which of two readings came from the apostles. But they were also able, in many cases, to allow both readings to stand and to offer interpretations on both readings. Romans 5:14 is a particularly interesting example. And if you look at your text there, there's kind of split evidence on this one. Most manuscripts read, I'll just read the English, however, death reigned from Adam up to Moses, even upon those who did not sin after the likeness of the transgression of Adam. So you have a may, a not. However, some manuscripts, both Greek and Latin, omit the not, completely changing the meaning of the clause. And Origen's commentary on Romans is pretty interesting. He first offers a lengthy commentary on the shorter text without the not, because that's the manuscript that he has. And then he says, here he says, if, on the other hand, as it reads in some manuscripts, and then he has about a two-page description or interpretation of what the text would mean if you add the not. So he gives an interpretation of both readings. And, I mean, they're obviously different interpretations, but you kind of come out to the same place at the end. So there's a desire, again, to preserve previous readings and even allow both readings to stand until more certain decisions can be made. And the manuscripts themselves seem to reflect this desire to preserve previous readings. We see this already in the corrections and annotations and manuscripts as early as the 3rd century. And here this is a close-up of that same page of Codex Sinaiticus, the beginning of Ephesians. Notice again, no chapters, no verse numbers. And I'll just point a couple of things out here. You see pretty obviously a famous problem at the beginning of Ephesians. Is Anapheso actually in the text or not? and the original hand of Codex Sinaiticus does not have it, right? Thelemata Theou Tois Hagiois. Now, this manuscript adds Possen, which is found only in a few, as a correction in the margin. Tois Usi Kai Pistois en Christo Jesu, you know, grace to you and peace. But here's the little flag on the play. You see it there? And then en Epheso written in the margin. So, and then you go down. Here's another Kai Soteron, so the God and Father and Savior of our Lord Jesus Christ. You notice the dots above that, marking those out for deletion. You have another Hamin added here, probably on the basis, well, this is probably from Philippians, this might be as well. But in any case, you notice that there's sort of a collection, a gathering together of readings from different places. And you can see what would happen in the next generation. Because somebody comes along and now tries to make a copy of this, and you have at least four decisions to make in about a dozen lines. And the text he produces will be, you know, pretty darn close, but he has to make decisions about what to include and what not to include. And it becomes, I think, relatively easy to see what happens to the transmission of the text. Now, these are not overly significant theologically. I did look up Stekart on this, on his Ephesians commentary, and he actually has some pretty good text critical discussion. But in the end, he says, how does he say it? This problem is of no concern to exegetes and theologians, only to historians, or something like that. So, I don't know. It's maybe, I think, a little too easy a way out. But anyway. Again, the early fathers and early manuscripts seem to be operating with a concern that nothing of the text becomes lost. Their concern is that readings which had been used by others in the church should not simply be discarded, at least not without ample reason. And this was at least in part due to the uncertainty of the process of copying a manuscript. Again, a copyist knows that he's going to make mistakes. And he probably has a little sympathy for the guy who copied the manuscript before him, right? So he's going to try to be as comprehensive as possible. I interpret this to mean that they seem to be concerned not to lose anything that may have been taught by the apostles and may carry the truth. And this humility before the text is summarized well by St. Augustine. I've used this quote several times, but it's a great quote. In a letter to Jerome, and here I'll put it up on the screen, you know, Augustine Tulla Lege. I have learned, quote, I have learned to yield respect and honor only to the books of Scripture. Of these alone do I most firmly believe that the authors were completely free from error. And if in these writings I am perplexed by anything which appears to me opposed to the truth, I do not hesitate to suppose that either, three things now, the manuscript is faulty, or the translator has not caught the meaning of what was said, because he's working in Latin, or I myself have failed to understand it. I think that's a pretty healthy attitude. He has this unblushing confidence in the authority of the Scriptures, yet at the same time, a deep humility with respect to his own abilities, and indeed, the manuscript that he's working with. If it's the fault of the manuscript, it should be corrected, and Augustine does in many places actually correct the manuscripts, and he's actually pretty good at it. If the fault is not with the copyist, then it may well lie with the translator, right? And if it's not with the manuscript of the translator, then like Luther, right, it might be me, and you say a prayer, and you go on, right, because the text has to stand. Yeah, this is taking longer than I thought, sorry. What is the New Testament text ontologically? It's kind of an interesting question. Again, we use a modern printed edition. We are reading the words of the New Testament writings in, and I don't mean this in an overly negative way, but it's a scrubbed, buffed, edited, and standardized format. Accents have been added. In some cases, aspirations, rough breathing marks. There's a few in some early manuscripts, but not that many. Punctuation and paragraphing, which, of course, is often a matter of interpretation, force us to read the text in a certain way, and you're, I'm sure, well aware of these examples. Chapter and verse numbers have been added, a phenomenon which actually concerns me because they split the text up into little chunks. And we can reference individual sort of scriptures, to talk like our evangelical friends, rather than the text as a whole. That page of Sinaiticus, right? How are you going to find Galatians 6, verse 10? Well, you kind of got to know Galatians and know the words of the text before you can find the specific reference that you're looking for. In other words, you need to know the thing before you can find the specific. I think that's helpful. You even see this in the Lutheran confessions. Apart from the formula of Concord, they were all written before verse divisions were added to the printed Greek New Testaments in 1551. So they will just refer to a chapter. And there's no verse reference. They've been added by later editors. So again, if you want to find the wording, you have to know the chapter well enough to find the verse. You need to know the context before you can read the individual passage. We no longer have to do that. But there are more fundamental issues than simply the way that editors make choices for us about how to read and interpret the text. We call it the New Testament, and Dr. Gieschen talked about this. We conceive of it as a consistent package, all 27 writings, always in the same order, always with consistent spelling most of the time, consistent formatting, consistent layout. And of course, the fundamental problem of the fact that the wording of our Greek editions are not matched by any single manuscript. They are composite texts produced word by word, reading by reading, on the basis of the manuscripts, with resulting texts that, again, differ from edition to edition, depending on the available manuscripts, depending on the methodology, and even as we now face with the 28th edition of the Nestle text, the conception of what is being reconstructed. You might have heard me talk about that somewhere. So again, as has been pointed out in numerous places, the Nestle 28 text no longer claims to reconstruct the original text of the writings of the New Testament. Rather, it seeks to reconstruct the Ausgangs text, or the initial text from which all known copies are derived. Now, I don't want to talk a lot about that here. I talked about that elsewhere, and I just want to make the point here that, again, our role, our responsibility as pastors, as teachers, is to equip ourselves to be able to understand what has happened to the text and be able to deal with questions as they come up, even questions that come up because of the very texts that we use, and that we needn't rely exclusively on the decisions of others, but we need a more, I think, ecclesial way to come at the text. I have to skip over a lot of stuff here because I'm not even getting to 1 Corinthians 14. Let me show you a couple of features that I think are evidence of an ecclesial use of the text in the manuscripts themselves. One feature that you're probably aware of are nomina sacra, sacred names. Larry Hurtado, who spoke here at the symposium a few years ago, made a significant point that these nomina sacra in the manuscripts for words like Jesus and Christ and God are evidence of early worship of Christ in the church, that they're direct evidence of how the early church viewed Jesus as divine. That's a very important point. I think we can push that a little bit, because here's, for example, a page of P46 or a snippet of P46 from early 3rd century, and I don't know how well you can see this, but what immediately are your eyes drawn to on the page? Right? You see a line here, a line there, a line there, a line there. If I had given you a larger page, you wouldn't see anything in the margins, but you see these lines in the text. They're the nomina sacra. And even in the experience of reading, these are highlighted as significant words. Pay attention to these words. Now, in your modern editions, you don't have any nomina sacra, which is really odd to me because every manuscript does this. Now, not consistently with some words. You know, sometimes pater is nomina sacra, sometimes not. But our editions are produced kind of just for generic use and not reflecting the practice of every single manuscript. It's actually kind of odd to me. And so again, it highlights that certain things are key and worthy of attention to the readers, the users of these texts. And I like this one in particular because it's 1 Corinthians 1, and you got the foolishness of the cross. So So Christ did not send me to baptize, rather to gospel, not in the wisdom of speaking, in order that the cross of Christ not be emptied, for the word of the cross, right, to those who are perishing, is foolishness. Now notice, staros has this nomina sacra on it, right? It's a sacred word, just like Christ is. So the word of the cross, right, is foolishness, right? The cross of Christ, that does something to us in the act of reading. It tells us something about how they're viewing the major aspects of the text. Now, granted, it's a bit of interpretation, but just as we learned from the fathers how to read the scriptures, I think we could learn from the manuscripts how to read the scriptures. Okay, a couple other pretty pictures, blah, blah. There's staroson, estaroson, actually a starogram. You see a combination of tau and rho, sort of a pictogram of Jesus on the cross. Again, Hurtado has made the point that this is, in fact, the earliest depiction of Jesus on a cross is in a biblical manuscript around the year 200. And you see these in P45, P66, P75. So again, your eye is going to focus on that, and the copyist is helping us to find key features very significant. You can go on. Here's some Manusco manuscripts. Good enough. I didn't even get to 1 Corinthians 14. All right. One other feature, and this is kind of, we do this a bit in our editions, the use of diplē in the manuscripts, these little kind of chevron greater than signs. Again, pointing out citations of the Old Testament. Our modern editions do put Old Testament citations in italics, so they somewhat continue this practice. But as users of the manuscript, this focuses your attention on certain items. And I think intentionally so. I talked about this yesterday. You know, Irenaeus uses a very, well, it's common in the early church, but Irenaeus talks about, you know, what the prophets foresaw, what Christ spoke, and what the apostles testified to. And the manuscripts themselves are, I think, conveying that same idea, that what the prophets spoke or foresaw and what Christ spoke and the apostles testified to is all the same thing. There's a consistency in that message. And so we should read these texts as part of that continuity of passing down the faith. I got some pretty cool textual variants that I can't talk about because it's a lot of fun, and I'll bore you. Sorry, I don't want to talk a little bit about 1 Corinthians 14. Can you give me 5 minutes? All right. Here. All right. 1 Corinthians 14, 34, 35, has become, I think, really one of the most hotly debated passages in New Testament textual criticism. As you are no doubt aware, it is the passage about the women should remain silent in the churches. Really beginning in 1989 in the commentary by Gordon Fee on 1 Corinthians, who was formally trained as a textual critic and did significant text critical work, Gordon Fee argued from a text critical perspective that those verses should not be considered part of the original text of 1 Corinthians and not coming from the apostle. The issue is that those two verses appear not at verse 34, 35 in some manuscripts, but rather appear at the end of verse 40. So it goes right from 33, as in all the churches of the saints, to, or has the word of God come out from you. And then 34, 35 come at the end. Now, bear in mind, every manuscript in existence today has those verses in one of those two places. There's no manuscript that omits them entirely. But Fee argued that because of this displacement, which he claimed was completely unique in the manuscript tradition of the New Testament, therefore we should consider these verses a marginal addition. That is, somebody wrote these verses in the margin, and a copyist came along later, and one copyist put it in verse 34, 35, another copyist put it at the end of verse 40. Okay, that's the basic argument. And it's been repeated any number of times. And this argument is pretty much standard fare now in most discussions of the issue of the role of women in the church from those who come from a we'll just say, egalitarian perspective. I'll just use that word. And the argument is essentially this. The pastoral epistles, as Dr. Geeshan mentioned, are considered deuteropauline, pseudo-Pauline, and so not written by Paul. And whoever wrote the pastoral epistles, you know, essentially didn't like women, and so wrote 1 Timothy 2, and then thought, hey, I better say something in 1 Corinthians 14, so use some of the same vocabulary, and wrote it into the margin of 1 Corinthians 14 in his manuscript. And then, of course, later copyists, you know, didn't know what to do. They wanted to keep things in there, so they mistakenly considered the pastoral epistles Pauline, and mistakenly considered 14:34-35 to be authentic. And we now know that we don't need to use these passages. And we should rely on stuff like 1 Corinthians 11, which says that women are allowed to pray and prophesy, and then they interpret that in a certain way. Okay. That's the gist of the argument. And I don't have time to go through this, I apologize. What I did in my work here is tried to look at the claim that this doesn't happen in any other manuscript, that these kind of displacements don't happen anywhere else. And so I'm going to kind of skim over this. I wish I could walk through all these examples. But I'll simply go to this one. What I found is that if you just sit down and read these three Greek-Latin manuscripts, DF and G, which have a Greek text and a parallel Latin text, that you find that these three manuscripts and then the related Latin manuscripts that have a similar Latin text, Old Latin pre-Vulgate text of those manuscripts, actually attest the exact same kind of shift of clauses and sentences elsewhere in the manuscript. So you see at Romans 16:3, you have a shift from 16:5, Romans 16:21, the addition or shift from 16:16, Romans 16:24, and this one's easily explainable because of the way the Romans ends in these three manuscripts, but a shift from verse 20. 1 Corinthians 16, you have an addition, this is interesting, which is based on Acts 18, but it's a consistent addition, and it tells us that they're comparing Acts with what's being described in 1 Corinthians 16 and the house church and trying to make them line up, right? Galatians 4, you have another addition, which is drawn from 1 Corinthians 12. So again, it's a comparison of manuscripts. And then you've got the shift of 1 Corinthians 14. So what I would suggest is that, in fact, we do have other examples of this kind of displacement. And it actually occurs in the exact same manuscripts that make the displacement at 1 Corinthians 14. Now, most of these are not cited in your Nestle apparatus. You have to actually read the manuscripts to find these things, and it's kind of fun to do that, although it takes a little time. And I will grant, I talked about this with Gordon Fee. He didn't find it convincing, and he didn't cite me in his updated commentary, so he doesn't buy it. To be fair, 1 Corinthians 14 is a longer block than the other examples. But I don't think that negates the point that these manuscripts show significant editorial revisions. I could walk through this at some other point, but the types of changes they're making are actually very consistent. The style of editing, they're based on keywords, situations with the house churches, even a little bit with Priscilla. And it might be a little bit motivated by the issue of the women in the church and God is not of disorder but of peace. But you'll have to read that at another point. All right, I'm out of time. I'll just say this. I would encourage you as pastors to not only keep the languages, but to familiarize yourselves with the manuscripts, the very plumbing that the church has used to pass down the text generation to generation. That this will sharpen your ability in Greek because you're going to have to figure out how that word should actually be spelled if it doesn't look familiar. You're going to have to figure out why the syntax seems a little odd in that place. You're going to figure out where some of the difficulties are. Frankly, I'd encourage you to preach a sermon using a manuscript. Just translate from that rather from your Nestle text. The advantages are you're sharpening your Greek, but also that you gain confidence and competence in dealing with the challenges to the scriptures that we face in our generation, that Dr. Geeshan kind of talked about. to get down to the very fundamental level. In our generation, the languages are being lost. In America, in Europe, the teaching of Greek, Hebrew, even Latin is declining. Even study of manuscripts. I think the church is going to need to step up and take ownership again of the text. And that will allow us to receive it and pass it on faithfully. I'll stop there. Thanks.